In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
On this episode, In Search of the Acoustic Science of the Divine.
Basically, if you want to see sound in pictorial form, you take a drum with you. And as my friend John Reed performed these experiments in the Great Pyramid about 25 years ago, he actually used the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber as the drum. He put a speaker into that. And then he covered the whole thing with a membrane and scattered it with very, very fine dust. And then basically he threw the internal frequencies of the pyramid at that membrane. And what do we get? We get hieroglyphics. It was astonishing.
If you enjoy Conspiracy Unlimited, why not become a Conspiracy Unlimited Plus member? For just $1.99 per month, you'll gain access to 2 bonus, exclusive, commercial-free episodes per month, plus access to my back catalog of episodes. To subscribe, just go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Gain Access to Premium Episodes. Again, go to conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com and click on Get Access to Premium Episodes, or click on the link in the episode notes. Conspiracy Unlimited Plus, for less than $2 per month. Why not sign up today?
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs, here's Richard Serrett.
Welcome to your Monday. David Elkington is here to explore the acoustic connections between the earth, the human brain, and sacred spaces. David's an academic and historian, specializing in Egyptology. He's best known perhaps for his work on the Jordan-led codices, the earliest known initiatory Christian documents. And he's the co-author of The Case for the Jordan Codices. He's lectured at Oxford and Cambridge universities and appeared on many TV programs, including Forbidden History. He's just released the second edition of The Ancient Language of Sacred Sound on the 20th anniversary of its first printing. Hey, David, welcome. How are you?
I'm fine, Richard. It's great to be here on this podcast. Thanks so much for inviting me.
My pleasure. The first edition of The Ancient Language of Sacred Sound, that came out, what, about 20 years ago?
Yeah, almost exactly 20 years ago. And I got approached to update and rewrite it, which the edition of 20 years ago was a very limited edition. And so it was time to get it out there to a broader audience, because in the meantime I've been working on other actually more controversial projects. But I thought that the publisher had done a really amazing job with it. Actually, I've chopped and changed a few things. I've taken away the initial first four chapters, which are no longer relevant. I've added a missing last chapter, and of course I've gotten some friends to write some good emendations for it. And of course, my great friend Robert Watts has written a lovely forward, which
yes,
is great.
I wanted to talk to you about the legendary movie producer Robert Watts. Of course, he produced the Star Wars sequel, The Empire Strikes Back, and so I wanted to ask you about how that came about, because it sounds like almost like he reached out to you after reading the book and finding some interesting connections between George Lucas's Jedi Knights and the Jedd.
Was really funny. It's funny you should have hit on that, because I had a friend who met Robert, about 14, 15 years ago, and he gave Robert a copy of my book. The next thing I know is that about sort of 2 or 3 weeks later, I get this extraordinary ecstatic call saying, calling me Dave. Now, I rarely allow anybody to call me Dave. I'm sort of pretty formal about my name. And I wondered who the Dickens this was. And then the guy turned around and said, "It's Robert Watts. I've just read your book." And I thought immediately, okay, Dave's fine. I don't mind Dave. Yeah. And we got talking about this. And he said, "Hey, Dave," he said, "we had no idea when we were making Star Wars that this whole idea of the Jedi Knights might actually be based on a kind of truth." He said, "We were blown away when we actually saw the subchapter heading, Return of the Jedd and I." And I, oddly enough, when I wrote that subtitle a few years beforehand, I wryly had them in mind when I wrote it down. Because as in my first edition, I think also in this book, I've left some of the punning titles in there because I think they're fun. Mm. And it helps people to understand as well the way you play with words, that words are... they're liquid. They're wonderful things with which you can twist and bend meaning, and you can create new words to express yourself. In which, if you're clever enough, or if you're a natural with language, people will understand immediately. And Robert got that big time. And we were talking about the whole Osirian Jedd pillar and everything else. And I said, you know, thinking about it, because I hadn't actually given it much thought, there is so much that is similar to the way the Jedi Knights have actually been portrayed that is actually there in the original Osirian cosmology.
Well, let's talk about the Jedd pillar, because people – and it's spelled D-J-E-D in English, D-J-E-D.
Yeah.
That comes from, I guess, Osiris. So tell us about the Jedd pillar and how that connects to the Jedi Knights.
Well, Osiris, of course, is a Greek translation of the Egyptian original. Originally, Osiris was called in the deep pre-dynastic period of Egypt, around about 3500 BC and backwards. He was actually called Jeddu or Jedi, which is really extraordinary. Mm. Now, what the Jedd is a pillar, and if atop the pillar we have kind of like four terraces where the Greek columns have these stylized capitals in the Corinthian, Doric, or Ionian modes. In Egypt, you just had these four layers that branch outwards in a kind of a semi-pyramidal shape. before meeting the pillar, which goes all the way down. Now, it's a fascinating concept because if we look at the very first of the Egyptian pyramids and probably the world's great breakthrough structure at the time, around about 3000 BC, we look at the step pyramid of King Djoser. If you look at the interior superstructure, you'll see that actually it has been constructed around a negative Djed pillar. Negative in the sense that the Djed pillar is constructed by the space created by the materials around it. And that's really curious because, of course, the pyramid itself is dedicated to that god, who is the god of resurrection. Mm. Now, interestingly, I believe, therefore, that myth, as it were, as in the myth of the Star Wars films, is a living, breathing entity that survives through history. It is not fantasy stories. It is not make-believe. It is real. And I think that fundamentally, it's a survival of ancient liturgies and ancient spiritual practices. You'll note that I don't use the word religion. Religion, in modern terms, kind of gives you a sense of dogma, of doctrine. That was less so in the early Egyptian period. And so what we have is this idea of the presence of the god in the pillar. Now, recently I've been working on a new discovery called the Jordan-led codices.
Yes.
And on some of the ancient documents, which are the earliest known Christian documents, which we're just in the process of age dating, there are representations of pillars, and around them we have the names of various divinities or angels. This is a survival of a very, very ancient tradition that survives, obviously, in deep archaic times from Egypt and elsewhere all over the planet. The god is somehow in the pillar. Now, if we then take ourselves across the waters to Australia, we have the wonderful Aboriginal people who are an amazing people. I have to say I'm actually in love with them. I'm in awe of them as well. They are people who have suffered very greatly due to colonialism, and it's something that needs to be rectified because their traditions and their ways of perception, their ways of walking the landscape are something that the modern world could really do with more knowledge of. And their sacred instrument happens to be a pillar. It's called a didgeridoo.
Right, right.
Not very far from the word Djed in Egypt.
Interesting.
You see, I believe that what initially happened was that in the dreamtime state of the Aborigines, they would actually originally, if they still don't do it, sing or chant the name of their divinities in the landscape, be it the wombat, the kangaroo, the crocodile, whatever, through that hollow pillar, and then it would resonate outwards. And it is a well-known fact that a didgeridoo played at somebody in a specific fashion, in a specific way, can help to alter their brainwave frequencies and therefore bring about an altered state.
Interesting. I just spoke with a woman who has designed, she calls it the harmonic egg, and it's for healing purposes, and it's light and color and sound therapy. And one of the instruments that's piped in there is the didgeridoo. I just wanted to come back to Star Wars for a moment, and because George Lucas, as Robert Watts points out in his foreword to the second edition of The Ancient Language of Sacred Sound, it talks about George Lucas being immersed in Joseph Campbell and the power of myth, and it just seems odd that he would have missed that, and that, you know, he would have missed that when he constructed or when he wrote the Star Wars trilogy.
George Lucas is an extremely creative man, and I personally started out by going to art school. I didn't go to university first. I went to art school because I wanted to widen my sense of the creative in terms of my approach to the phenomenal world, but also in my approach to the intellectualizing and understanding of that world. There's too much, to my mind, and this is a feeling that's become stronger as I've gone on. There's too much conditioning going on in our universities for us to think in particular ways, whereby if you break out of the garden, you are suddenly an outsider and you are made to feel as such because you are thinking differently. It's a very, very dangerous thing that's happening. And you can see in today's world, there's this considerably growing anti-intellectual stance, this anti-academic view, brought about because of the lack of an ability to think freely. Now, with the creative person, such as George Lucas, you are overwhelmed by the need to be creative. You are overwhelmed by the need to express yourself in that way. And so you take another path. You take the mystical path of the creation. The hero in the myths worldwide is the one who brings down the knowledge. He draws it down from heaven in the shamanic state. And then he recreates it. So in other words, he is creating anew from the original creation. And that is what a creative person does. So in a sense, George can be forgiven because he's not about the retention of knowledge and being academic and saying, oh, by the way, I got this from that, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, right.
He's put it down on paper. It's fluid and it's worked. It's been left to people like me to come up with the obvious links, which perhaps at the time were not so obvious.
I see what you're saying. That's an interesting point. So, in I guess in some ways, George Lucas is the hero of his own work. So the thesis of your book, The Ancient Language of Sacred Sound, The Acoustic Science of the Divine, religion is an ancient language of scientific expression. A scientific expression in what form?
Sound, resonance, in terms of the way in which we marshal our consciousness in order to understand that which is around us. And this is the key point. I have a funny feeling that when we had actually performed the original resonance experiments at sacred sites, we'd seen how sound wave patterns gathered on the machinery we'd looked at, particularly in cymatic form, mm-hmm. matched the decorations of the interior to the degree where we realized they weren't simply decorations, they were linguistic expressions. Now, what's interesting is that these sites, like the pyramids, we have Osiris, we have Quetzalcoatl at the Central American pyramids, and so on and so forth, is that the hero is the essential aspect of the liturgy of these rites, of these places. And it seemed to me that somehow the hero is intimately linked via his relationship with the Earth Mother and the Sky Father. And I suddenly realized, of course, that the great clue to this was in the opening of the Gospel of John. Whatever you think about Christianity, reading the opening chapter of St. John's Gospel is always worth getting nutrition from, spiritual nutrition. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, that's interesting because it's telling us that in the beginning there was a word, in other words, a rhythmic vibration. And if you translate one word into Latin, you end up with the term universe. Yeah, exactly. So what you have with the hero Jesus, the hero of the Christian religion, is a man who brings the word. In other words, I think that the Christian religion is harking back to a much more ancient time. I think it's harking back to the event on Mount Sinai, where Moses comes down the mountain with the Ten Commandments. But hang on a minute, Hebrew wasn't said to have been invented at that time. Or was it? Who brought the language? It's always the hero in the legends who brings the script. Well, he becomes the arbiter between God and his people, or the gods and their peoples.
Right.
So, what we end up with is this phenomenon where at the sacred site, we've left the cave environment. We've now emerged into the open landscape of the world around us. And the first thing we do, we don't build schools, banks, shops, or anything like that. We build the sacred site. Why? Because it's a telephone box to stay in touch with Mother Earth.
Right, right.
You know?
If I could, I just wanted to go back to cymatics because people may not be familiar with these experiments that you did and what cymatics are. So these sound wave patterns, I guess they vibrate a plate and they arrange particles on the plate, like, let's say, sand. I've seen experiments conducted with fine grains of sand. And so they create this pattern. So what you're saying, in these experiments, the sound waves generated inside these sacred sites, let's say a cathedral, would create patterns that also mirror, I don't know, Celtic symbols or the Hebrew alphabet.
Exactly, precisely that. You basically, if you want to see sound in pictorial form, you take a drum with you, and as my friend John Reed performed these experiments in the Great Pyramid about 25 years ago, he actually used the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber as the drum. He put a speaker into that, and then he covered the whole thing with a membrane and scattered it with very, very fine dust. And then basically he threw the internal frequencies of the pyramid at that membrane. And hey presto, what do we get? We get hieroglyphics. It was astonishing.
That is extraordinary. And what were you finding in Celtic locations?
Well, everybody's familiar with the Book of Kells and the fabulous Celtic knotwork of Celtic crosses. That's exactly what we got again. In India, we have the Om and that wonderful, you know, backwards three shape, etc., and so on and so forth. We've got the same phenomenon wherever you go. And it's always within the same band of frequencies or harmonics of those frequencies. So it seems to me that the adoration of the hero in these legends is actually an original mode of saying thanks to the hero arbiter who brought this wisdom down to his people that they might use it for further communication. And let's not forget that the great tragedy of the sacred site in many ways is that once language in its written form, in script form, has been discovered, mankind begins to move away from the sacred site gradually. You know, obviously it's taken 5,000 years so far, but in Earth's terms, that's a fairly short period of time. We've moved away from the site now because we've got our language. We know how to leave a note for the milkman. Thank you very much indeed.
Right.
But actually, we need to start going back to these places and realizing that actually there's a very subtle, one might say emotional link between us and Mother Earth, who resonates at a particular frequency of vibration, which is intimately linked to us and our brain.
The Schumann resonance.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, it's incredibly important. And that's why I wonder about, you know, these ideas of going to Mars and elsewhere. It seems to me we have so little understanding of the innate connection we have with our own planet that going to another planet seems to me to be almost like a future act of corporate suicide, because I'm not sure that astronauts are going to really survive too long without an understanding of the basic frequencies of those places. I might be wrong. But it seems to me that as we've been nurtured within the embrace of Mother Earth, perhaps we should take an aspect of that rhythmic vibration with us in order to actually insert ourselves onto the Martian surface as we gradually get used to its own independent rhythm.
Hmm. I just wanted to come back to the Schumann resonance for a moment, because the connection between the Schumann resonance, which is what, between 7 and 10 hertz, I guess it fluctuates.
It fluctuates.
And human brain waves and the different levels, the alpha and the beta and the theta brain waves. Just can we spend a few minutes talking about what that all means, the connection and how they interact?
Yeah, actually, it's interesting. I've just written an article on it, actually. I mean, basically, we go into a state of or a change of consciousness twice a day, when you go into and come out of sleep. Because, of course, when you're going into sleep, your brain's relaxing. So therefore, it's rhythmically vibrating at a much slower rate. So what we have at the base level, the lowest of these bands, is actually the delta rhythm, which is 0.5 to 4 hertz or vibrations per second. And this is, you know, this is the state of deep sleep. This is where you're completely in the land of nod. Then The next band we have are theta waves, which are 4 and 7 vibrations per second, or hertz. And this is the state at which we're dreaming, we're half awake, or you can be musing in a very deep state of meditation. And then the next band is the crucial band for what we're talking about. It's alpha rhythms, which are 7 to 13 hertz. And these are a state of passive alertness where the mind is, it's relaxed to the point of emptiness. And this is the wave band that's associated with altered states of consciousness, the frequency of expanded awareness. Beyond that, as you surge into the day, as you wake up, you then go into the fourth level, which is the delta frequency, which is 13 to 30 hertz, which is the frequency of normal everyday wakefulness. And so what we have really is we have a harmonic connection between the Earth's own frequency of 32 hertz and the fact that, we have the brain that's between 7 and 13 hertz, generally around about 8, which is obviously a harmonic of 32, begins then to connect with Mother Earth, the point at which we begin to draw down that wisdom in ancient times or today, where we begin to see that we're not only in an altered state, but we're in a state where we can actually solve problems. I mean, you've obviously heard that. We've all heard that maxim that if you've got a problem, you sleep on it.
Right, right. Yeah, inventors always talk about inventing it first in the dream state, in the dream world, and then the
exactly. Yeah. Well, look at Medvedev when he had that dream, that profound dream in the late 19th century, and woke up the next morning with the entire periodic table, at his disposal. All he had to do was sit down and write it down, and thankfully he did. Unlike Coleridge, who was only a third of the way through his great, great poem Kubla Khan, only to actually have his state of awareness completely smashed by a knock on the door by the postman.
What happens when we are separated from the natural background residence? 5G, 4G, we're swimming through this electronic smog, radio waves, and so forth. What happens? What is happening to us as we're separated from that background residence?
I think there's still a lot of research going on that. But if we look at the modern world and modern technology, what you're looking at really is quite impactful. Before the world became electric, we had a generally good pattern of Earth resonance, and you could go to places and you would feel the numinosity. You still can, but now it's getting problematic because the world is so full of electricity and electromagnetic waves and communication lines, etc. To the degree where if you look at the Earth from outer space and the impact of all of this, it's like the innards of a golf ball. You've got elastic bands wound around each other, winding round and round and round the Earth. And it's kind of keeping in the Earth's own natural rhythm, it seems. And so, of course, we get a lot of interference from that. We get it from our cell phones, what we carry in our pockets, or our laptops when we look at the screen. We get it from, the power of our televisions. It's kind of creating a subtle change in us where we've become a lot more detached from our planet than perhaps is healthy. And it seems to me that this is a part of the great environmental crisis that we're undergoing at the moment. We need to start switching off for a little bit, not permanently, for a little bit to get back in touch, not just with the Earth, but ultimately with ourselves. Because if we do that, I think we'd be a far happier, more relaxed race.
More of my conversation with David Elkington when Conspiracy Unlimited returns.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Have you ever wondered what it's like to be buried in an avalanche?
Weird foreign feeling of despair.
Or how it feels to crash a skydive?
I remember hearing a thud, feeling my body hit the ground.
Or how you would react if you were being attacked by an alligator?
At the end of my leg is this huge alligator head on my leg.
These are the stories you'll hear on the podcast called What Was That Like? True stories told by the actual person who went through it. You'll hear from a victim of an attack.
Dragging me into the bathroom and saying, I'm going to kill you, now you're going to die.
You'll hear from a man who discovered a baby.
How could this be? How could there be a baby on the ground?
And you'll hear actual 911 calls.
Clinky County 911.
There's a man at my back door. He's trying to get in.
What Was That Like is a podcast about real people in unreal situations. Search for What Was That Like on any podcast app or at whatwasthatlike.com.
I'm Andrew Gold, a fallen BBC journalist interviewing the heretics and rebels brave enough to speak out against mainstream narratives. Here's Coleman Hughes, John Ronson, and the Trigonometry podcast guys bringing controversy to the fore.
How'd you feel if a person of a different race moved in next door?
I spent a while with a politically correct faction of the Ku Klux Klan.
The system punishes people for wrongthink. It's heartbreaking.
Here's My Unorthodox Life Netflix star Julia Hart on getting out of a Hasidic Jewish cult.
Why can't I be okay with being silent and subservient? Everyone else is.
And biologist Richard Dawkins on trans activism.
It's perfectly legitimate to say, I'm a man, but I feel feminine. But to then say, therefore I am a woman, is just a betrayal of language.
Now it's your turn. Rebel against the mainstream and find a home in this sensible alternative space by subscribing to Heretics Podcast.
Listen up, true crime fans.
There's a big murder trial underway.
Dateline is launching a new podcast with Andrea Canning.
Welcome to Dateline True Crime Weekly.
We'll cover breaking crime news around the country with the best reporters on the case, NBC News analysts, and Dateline producers on the ground.
Over. Break it down for us.
You'll just get behind-the-scenes scoops from crime scenes to courtrooms.
So tell us what he said.
Listen to Dateline True Crime Weekly now and catch new episodes every Thursday.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you grind your teeth at night? Well, that's not unusual. There are about 40 million Americans who do. We grind our teeth for a lot of reasons. We're stressed and anxious, or maybe because of an unusual bite. Teeth grinding will lead to worn enamel, tooth decay, sleeplessness, and expensive dental procedures. Sure, you could buy a custom-fitted night guard, but that'll set you back $200 or $300, and you'll grind through several of those every year. Instead, try Smile Brilliance Lab Direct process, and you get the same custom-fitted night guard for as little as $45. That's right, $45 per guard. Smile Brilliant also has custom fitted whitening trays and the Carry Pro electric toothbrush. Smile Brilliant. Take a moment and visit www.smilebrilliant.com and use Conspiracy at checkout to receive 30% off. 30%. www.smilebrilliant.com and use Conspiracy at checkout. Smile fearlessly with Smile Brilliant.
Theoretical physicists say that there's as many as 12 hyperdimensions. Here are just three of them. Conspiracy Unlimited. Conspiracy Unlimited. Conspiracy Unlimited. Pretty cool, huh? Here's an extra one. Conspiracy Unlimited. Hey, how about one more? Conspiracy Unlimited. And the great thing is we have six hyperdimensions left. Conspiracy Unlimited.
Five.
Or something like that. I'll ask Richard later.
David Elkington, the author of The Ancient Language of Sacred Sound, is here. Going back into these sacred sites and temples and churches, and I married a lovely Greek woman, so I'm Orthodox, and during the Sunday liturgy, we hear the chanting, the psalties, we call them, or the psalters would be the equivalent in a Jewish religion. And then the Tibetan monks, of course, they have that wonderful throat singing. We have, you know, Gregorian chants and so forth. What is happening to our brain waves? Do we know when we're listening to this? And what is the purpose?
I think the purpose of hymnal is, again, an unconscious one in the sense that I don't think it was designed specifically originally to get us into these states. It just is something that came naturally to us. The further you go back in history, the more it becomes revelatory in linguistic terms. today you and I are speaking in conversation together, and we're speaking in a monotone way. I'm sad to say this, but I'm Irish, but I don't have the beautiful lyrical Irish accent. I really wish I did, but it would be false of me to try and copy it. I was brought up largely in the UK, so I speak with a UK accent. But if we look at the Irish accent, it's actually a throwback to the deep and ancient past where people sang their language. We have an extraordinary record, and I'll give you the quote now. It's Enuma Elish Lanabu Shamanu, and this is the beginning of the great Mesopotamian story of creation. And it's the word Shamanu that we should actually look at, because, of course, from it we get our word shaman. And to translate, when on high the heavens were not yet named, we were singing creation into being. The gods were singing their words when they uttered them, when they uttered the creation. So we, in terms of being created beings ourselves, emerged in an evolutionary way to sing language, to sing our thoughts. It's a well-known factor that if you're dyslexic, if you try to sing your way through a book when you're reading it, you're going to have a lot more success in getting through it than you would if you read it in just a monotone way as a series of words linked.
The same with stutterers. There was the famous country singer Mel Tillis, who was a stutterer, but when he sang, not a hint of stuttering.
It's amazing, isn't it? Mm. And then, you know, we can come forward. I know of a lady teacher who had a new class of very, very boisterous 12 to 13-year-olds. I write about it in the book, actually. And she was actually at her wit's end. These were a particularly boisterous year, and she was considering her career options, frankly. She simply could not keep them under control. It was creating great tensions with her. She'd always been a very successful teacher, but one lunchtime, as they were out in the playground, she drove her car to a local shop, and she bought her lunch, and she noticed some CDs, and she thought she needed to relax. So she bought some Mozart, the clarinet quintets. She went back to her classroom. She put the CD into the CD player. She put her feet on her desk. She lounged back in her chair, and she shut her eyes. At the end of the clarinet quintet, she looked up to see her class there at their desks, completely quiet. She hadn't even heard the bell go for the end of lunch. And this is an extraordinary phenomenon that happens on a regular basis with that particular piece of Mozart. You can quieten people. You can quieten those who are active, overactive. It's an astonishing phenomenon. Mm. So music is this extraordinary link to our deep and ancient past, but also to that idea of what the earth truly is. It's another expression of language.
Right. We're all just one. All matter, I guess you could look at all matter as in terms of cymatics, right? If the earth and human flesh and bone, it's all cymatics.
It is indeed. Everything is rhythmic vibration. If you ever get asked to pose for an art class who want to draw you, take it up.
That's never going to happen.
I'm not talking about taking your clothes off. I'm merely talking about in front of a class, and you've got to do something which you will find really, really difficult, and that is to stay still.
Mm. Right.
You gradually relax into the pose. Now, I've done this recently, actually. A friend of mine's an artist, and I sat for his class. I wanted to do the portrait thing, so and I sat there, and you relax into the pose. But gradually, as people concentrate on your face, they want to kind of draw your eyes. And so what you try to do is you try to still yourself completely. You get into a relaxed state, and gradually you will notice as you still your vision, it begins to disappear. As your muscle movements in your eyes, which are around about 40,000 movements per second, as they begin to still, the world as you know it begins to fade away. it begins to look like a snowstorm. That is what happens when you still the vibrations.
Remarkable.
Now reverse that and look at the idea of God creating from out of nothing, the creation, from out of no thing, the whole of everything. It's a fantastic concept, isn't it?
It is. This may sound like I'm going off on a bit of a, what I call a tangerine or a tangent, but the idea of crop circles, is it possible that they are a cymatic expression of the Earth's resonance? I mean, people are talking about, you know, crop circles are from UFOs or some sort of light being, but is it possible that that's what they are? There's cymatics from the Earth's natural resonance.
Yeah, I think that's very likely the case, to be honest with you. I think also other authors before me have brought this up about 20 odd years ago. The whole idea of crop circles, UFOs, etc. I mean, why do we call them unidentified flying objects when actually they should be UFSs? It's an unidentified flying subject because the whole thing is so subjective.
True.
And what you have in the medieval period, we have engravings of this phenomenon known as the mowing devil.
Yes.
And there we see him mowing in a crop circle type form. Now, it's interesting because, you know, we today would call these strangers from outer space, to use a 50s term, we call them aliens. Now, interestingly enough, the word alien is actually an inversion of the 16th letter of the Hebrew, Greek, and Egyptian alphabets, which is called El Ayin, and it's the letter O in the modern world. It's shaped like a letter O. And its original intent was an expression of the pineal gland, which is in your forehead, which, of course, if you stimulate, takes you into an altered state.
Right.
So perhaps our aliens are actually the angels of our unconscious. Perhaps these things that we see up in the sky are actually a reflection of consciousness. And what if, I mean, this is a big maybe, but what if outer space is actually, you know, remembering what I've just said about posing for the artist, the vision disappearing, what if outer space, therefore, the cosmos, is a reflection, a physical reflection of our deep unconscious?
Wow. That's remarkable. I want to shift gears here. I mean, we could go off and talk about that forever. I want to talk about water and the idea that water, you know, can store information. What does that mean in terms of what we've been talking about and sound and the effectiveness of things like the efficacy of holy water, the healing waters of Lourdes in France, the, you know, people make pilgrimages to the Ganges River. Is there any way we can tie that together?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point you've made there. We did some experiments regarding wells. I read a report many years ago of a well in the East Anglian part of England, in which the water authorities had tested the well water from a holy well, the well of St. Ethelberga. I think it was Ethelberga. It was one of the Ethels, anyway, a Saxon name. And they'd introduced bacterium into it. And the bacterium had actually done something quite remarkable. They took tap water from the local area, and they took river water from the local area, and they introduced the same bacilli into it, and it spread. It was doubling every few seconds or so, and therefore it was thriving. But when they placed it into the holy water, it died. It was kaput. And it seems that holy well water comes from a range below the earth where it becomes very heavily intoxicated. It becomes very heavily influenced by radon emissions. And therefore, it has this ability to be quite, I guess, sterile, and therefore it is truly healing. I found this profound because again, we have this tradition in medieval times of holy wells and their holy water. Ancient humanity seemed to know these things naturally. Where did they get the knowledge? How did it appear? Well, it's fairly obvious that they drew it down from somewhere. They drew it down from heaven, to use their own terminology. They drew it from somewhere. They drew it, I believe, from a deeper well of a collective consciousness, no doubt. We need to do more research on this. But, you know, I brought the first book out 20 years ago. I think it was around about 2005, 2006, that Masaru Emoto mm-hmm. brought out his remarkable series of books on the shape of water. And he was taking droplets of water and he was throwing emotional intent at it, from shouting at it to hating it, to loving it, to singing at it. And the shapes that were coming out when frozen were reflecting that emotional sense. Now, this was extraordinary because actually it's completely obvious that this should be the case. We were born within the embrace of our Earth, and the Earth Mother is a very loving being. Why on Earth would she bring us up in hate? We wouldn't have survived. It seems to me that water, which is everywhere, I mean, it's 80% of the human body. If we were to take this knowledge and to treat with it properly, we could heal ourselves very effectively.
You mentioned Mozart earlier, and I think it was the clarinet concerto, whether Emoto ever tried playing that piece and seeing the impact on the crystalline structure of water, or what the crystalline structure of water in a human looks like after being exposed to the clarinet concerto.
That would be a fascinating thing to do. Perhaps we should get in touch with him and ask him to undertake that. I wouldn't do it myself because I wouldn't want to take away from his work, which I think is pretty amazing. But you know, you bring up another interesting aspect there of this research, and that is that we live in a crystalline cosmos. It is said that 10 to the power of minus 30 seconds after the Big Bang, the universe was actually pyramidal in shape. The shape of the expression of the shape has lost me. I've lost the word, but however, it was crystalline in shape. If we look at the Platonic solids for the shapes of crystals, again, it seems to be a knowledge that he drew down from somewhere. It seems remarkable. We look at blood. Blood is liquid crystal. It's flowing through our veins. Mm. Water is crystalline. It's the only liquid that, when we freeze it, it expands, which tells us an awful lot about it. Now, take these crystalline forms and let's look at our ancient monuments. Look at pyramids. I noticed something really interesting. Well, certainly was for me as well. At the beginning of civilization, those who were living in the Mesopotamian basin by where the Euphrates and other rivers met the sea were having to survive in those marshlands, and they were consuming dairy products from newly domesticated cattle. Yet the human body, when it is very, very young, in the form of babies, cannot digest dairy solids.
Right.
So what ancient humanity did was to plant barley in those river delta regions. Barley is able to actually convert saltwater land into freshwater land. Okay.
Mm.
And it takes salt out of the environment. So salt, again, is incredibly important for the bodily system. You have to have enough salt in you to
right.
keep going. It's a very fine balance. So they were using barley water to actually break up the solids in the guts of the infants. I remember myself being on barley water when I was a child back in the 60s. It's a remarkable thing. And barley is really interesting because I remember recording a whistle from a field of barley in a field in Dorset about 25 years ago. If you look at barley, when it's ready to actually be fertilized, it grows the whiskers, and then from the whiskers dangle the receptors for pollen transmitting bees. But Barley is only fertile twice a day during that stage of its life, and that is in the evening and in the morning, i.e. alpha wave rhythms yet again. They resonate at those alpha frequencies, which again tells us about the hero, and the hero is quite often associated with barley.
Ah, interesting.
You see, great barley cakes were woven into the form of the hieroglyph of Osiris and left in front of the Great Pyramid at the end of the harvest, so that the next season, when the waters came and the rains came, they would begin to sprout anew. They would become green. And of course, we have Osiris portrayed as a green man in hieroglyphs, because of course he's a god of fertility as well as a god of resurrection. But not only on top of that, if we now go from barley to salt, take a salt crystal. Don't get the flaked crystals, get salt crystals themselves. And if you buy a packet of them, buy one where you know that there are whole crystals, and have a really good look at them. Look at them under a microscope or a magnifying glass. Then take that salt crystal and compare it to the pyramid of the sun or the pyramid of the moon, the Teotihuacan in central Mexico. You've got one of the same thing. They're absolutely astonishingly similar. And it's remarkable. Again, salt is associated with the coming of the hero. Quetzalcoatl was known to be a god of salt. He was a god who helped in the trade of salt. The Romans used salt as money. The word salary means literally salt. That's how they were paid, because it was quite a commodity in those days. So you can imagine worldwide, salt was a very, very precious substance.
Making some just phenomenal connections here. You mentioned the pyramid. What was happening inside the pyramids in ancient Egypt? Was it an initiation rite going on? What was happening there?
Well, the answer to that is we simply do not know. We don't have many records. The few records we do have are very sparse and very fragmentary. But I think that if you're looking at it from what I would call an obvious viewpoint, the first thing you note about the Great Pyramid is that it's the only pyramid in Egypt where its inner chambers are actually above ground. All the rest have chambers that descend down into the ground, but none above. The Great Pyramid has a chamber going down below ground, but the King's Chamber, the Queen's Chamber, the Grand Gallery, they're all above ground. And this is really very interesting indeed. John Reed wrote a paper on this subject called Egyptian Sonics, in which he posited the idea that the Wainman-Dixon brothers back in the 1880s discovered the so-called ascending shafts from the King's and Queen's chambers. They actually noted that the Queen's Chamber shafts had been they'd been opened, and it was the King's Chamber shafts that were closed. It's one of the two. It's the other way around. However, what's curious about this is the idea that, in the sarcophagus, you've got this extraordinary resonant frequency. I forget what the actual frequency is. It's in the book. But it basically is the same frequency as the heartbeat of a newborn child. So that tells you immediately the sarcophagus is actually it's surprisingly small. You're talking about here, if somebody was buried in that, they were a really very short person, and yet you look at the sarcophagus in the King's Chamber, and to my mind, it's a bit like Arthur C. Clarke's monolith in 2001: A Space Odyssey. In fact, Clarke was inspired by the Great Pyramid in designing that monolith for his story, which was originally pyramidal in shape. Now, it's interesting because obviously the pharaohs of Egypt were incarnations of the god Horus, who was the son of Osiris. So the pattern is this: the old pharaoh dies, he goes from being Horus to turning into his father Osiris. His son becomes the living Horus. So in other words, the son has to be reborn. And why not be reborn in the pyramid if that's what the, you know, the place was being built for. It seems to me hardly likely that the Egyptians, who were such an extraordinarily vibrant and celebratory people, not really obsessed with death, they were obsessed with life, actually. The so-called Book of the Dead is actually called, in translation, accurate translation, the Book of Coming Forth by Day. So therefore, what we have is this celebration of life. So if Pharaoh is reborn, and this is actually echoed in the pattern of the sarcophagus, then it's really curious that the ascending shafts in the queen's chamber are closed. It seems to me that they almost perform the task of fallopian tubes. It's almost as if they are kind of there to fertilize the cosmic egg, allowing the pharaoh to be reborn. So we go back to my initial point. The whole of the pyramid was about a liturgy, a ritual, a rite. The drawing down not only of new life, but also the drawing down of extraordinary knowledge. And that's why I say at the end of the book, I think it's in the last chapter, it might well be in the epilogue, I talk about the mermaid, because, of course, the word for pyramid in ancient Egyptian is mer. And it is very curious that when the Wayman Dixon brothers made the breakthrough to finding the ascending shafts in the Queen's Chamber, they found a knife called the Peshenkef knife. And if you look at it, it was designed for cutting the umbilicus of newborn children. Ah. And it's got a double blade that looks together, all together, like a mermaid's tail. So, of course, midwives were women. Women are the mothers of our children. They know what they're doing. And that was the ancient tradition. So, therefore, if they apply the Peshenkef knife, then they are literally the maids of the mermaids. And of course, you've got the great sea of the cosmos. They're also called in Greek legend sirens, which again implies sacred singing. And the whole idea of them dragging people down to their deaths, I suspect, is dragging a people down to their spiritual deaths so they are reborn. This is all about sound and resonance yet again. Everything comes back to acoustics. It all comes back to sound. And I believe that sound is the key to the world's mythology. We haven't taken it half as serious as we should do.
The ancient language of sacred sound, the acoustic science of the divine. David, what an incredible journey. Thank you so much for this. How do we get a copy of the second edition?
It's on sale from the 25th of April from Inner Traditions. And if you approach them, I'm sure that they will be very happy to forward copies or to give you the outlets as to where it's going to be sold.
David, a great pleasure speaking with you. I hope we can do it again.
Richard, thank you so much for your time, and thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, before I dim the lights in my little studio beneath the stairs, I'll be back in a few moments to tell you a little bit about the next edition of Conspiracy Unlimited. Reduce stress and enhance your immune system. ESS 60 from C60 Evo. C60 is the carbon-60 molecule known to deliver more than 172 times the power of vitamin C. 172 times. ESS 60 is the purest form of C60, a known antiviral, antibacterial, and anti-inflammatory remedy that works. ESS 60 neutralizes free radicals from cell metabolization and external toxins to help minimize inflammation and maximize detoxification. Further, people report better sleep, more energy, and renewed mental clarity when they take our ESS 60 organic oil. To order your miracle molecule ESS 60, click on the C60 Evo link in the episode notes for this podcast, or go to c60evo.com/Richard-Serrett. c60evo.com/Richard-Serrett. Buy now and save 10% by using the coupon code EVRS at checkout. Again, use the coupon code EVRS at checkout. Coming up next time, the Sean Connery James Bond Canon Part 2. pop culture historian Arlen Schumer examines the second of the Bond film franchise, From Russia with Love.
Armin Darris shot himself while they were still making From Russia with Love. You know, it does add this other weird dimension to the film. A poignancy also, because originally the producers were going to let him get out of the film. They thought, you know, don't you want to just, you know, go home, be with your family? He said, no, I want this film not only financially to support my family, but I want it to be my legacy. So that's when they came to the agreement of, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to shoot all your scenes in Pinewood. And they must have picked up right then and there and went to Pinewood. And maybe they had to go back to Turkey and film. I don't know how that worked out. But the bottom line is they bent over backwards to help him. And he succeeded. He ended up filming all of the scenes, even though he was in pain, and ended up, you know, right after his last scene was shot, he went to Los Angeles and killed himself in the hotel room. So, but he succeeded in giving us his legacy, because when you watch From Russia with Love, he's a great character. And I mean, he has a couple of great scenes and, you know, he's a big part of the film.
Until then, I'm Richard Serrett. So long for now.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review, because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need constant petting.